Hey, good evening, everyone. We are working our way through the essence of the Bhagavad Gita, and we're actually making progress. Look at us. I've been doing conversations with Yogananda on Tuesday night programs here in Palo Alto, and I'm on class number 122, and we're actually finishing. We're not finished, but we're finishing. So it does happen. So we are on class 32 with this one, and we're in no hurry. But little by little, it's just marvelous to go through it. The last cycle that we went through, the last verses of chapter 3, which was up through 3:16, were a little abstract, and I did my best, but I'm not sure it was the most inspired or insightful section that I've done so far. We're hoping for better tonight. So we are now up to chapter 15 of Swamiji's book, which does not match the chapters of the Gita, because we're still on chapter 3 of the Gita. There's 18 chapters. And we're up to stanza 17. Chapter 15 of Swami's book is called Freedom Through Action. And chapter 14, which we just finished, was called Directional Development. The longer I am on the spiritual path, the more these little small phrases begin to mean a lot. Directional development, which is what we just finished, and a lot of it was more grounded, and I could speak about it, was closer to my own level of experience, and I could talk about it more readily, is really one of the most useful concepts on the spiritual path. I won't belabor it here because I did talk about it a lot, because it simply tells us that we have to just be pointed in the right direction, and that we have to understand that it took us a long time to get this confused, and therefore it's going to take us a little while to get unconfused. And the most important aspect of the path is that we're moving in the right direction. The Dalai Lama is reported to have said that if you're going to evaluate your spiritual progress, you should never think in time periods less than a decade, which I've done enough decades now to be able to say that's a really good number, because you can look back 10 years, almost everyone can look back 10 years and think, wow, I've grown a lot in 10 years. So instead of feeling that, oh, it's just endless, and I just keep meeting the same problems over and over again, you can see that it's a spiral staircase. And even though we kind of keep circling around and crossing the same sections of our karma, we do it on a higher level. I was chuckling because in the early years of Ananda, when we were developing at Ananda Village, and we had all this land, and everything was really new, and we had so little money. I remember I saw in one of the early newsletters, there was a request that people would turn in those little wires that would tie a loaf of bread closed. They were collecting those little bread ties. I mean, can you imagine what a cheap item that was? But it was like everything was so frugal. And nowadays, you know, Ananda functions globally, but we're still functioning at zero. There's just more zeros. It's the same. It's the same. If there's extra, we use it in some creative way. We're just not here to accumulate, and we don't have stockholders. You know, it's a how can we serve system. Well, anyway, freedom through action is what we're going to deal with now. Let me just. Oh, it's not that long a chapter. Look at that. Freedom through action is shorter than some of the chapters we've had. We'll see. It's the rest of the third chapter of the Gita. So now we're on chapter 3, stanza number 17. For him whose only love is the Supreme Self, who delights in the Self and rests contentedly in the Self, no duty remains. Of course, Self there is the capital S, which means God. For him whose only love is a supreme God, who delights in the divine and rests contentedly in the divine, no duty remains. Such a person, and then 3:18, such a person has nothing to gain by performing action in the world, nor anything to lose by not performing it. He is dependent on no one and nothing outside of the self. I think we can just sort of, well, when Master was learning the Gita from Sri Yukteswar, they would read a verse and then they would sit and just meditate on it for a long time. I could do that with you, but that isn't sort of the bargain that we've made. So, but reading this, I was just thinking, and rest contentedly in the self. Just sort of contemplating for a moment what that means. One of the among the many descriptions, both in the Bhagavad Gita and in much of the verbalization of Swamiji and other great teachers, is this word contented in oneself. There's a supposedly true story of something that George Bernard Shaw said when he was at a party and he was sitting quietly off by himself. And since he was such a famous wit, for him to be sitting off by himself was not a good sign to his hostess. So she went to him and said, "Mr. Shaw, I hope you're enjoying yourself." And he said rather acerbically, if that's how you pronounce that word, pointedly, he said, "Yes, I am enjoying myself. In fact, that's all I am enjoying." Now, of course, the same remark could have been made by a sage, and it would have had entirely different meaning. Bernard Shaw was casting aspersions, if he ever actually said that, casting aspersions on all the other egoic selves around him and putting primary importance on his own egoic self. It was self with a small s, in other words. You know, these people don't interest me, so I'm going to put myself off by myself and I will entertain myself. To rest contentedly in the self is to realize that there is no separate existence that needs to be comforted. That there is the realization that I am never separate from the infinite, and therefore what would compel me to move outward from my inner self. Now, these verses in this little section deal with a subtlety of this which is well worth considering, because self-realized masters are often exceedingly active in the world. So to rest contentedly in the self is not the same as doing nothing, but it's an attitude of inner peace, would be one way to call it, but it's a peace beyond what most of us think of as peace. There's a story in my book, Swami Kriyananda as We Have Known Him, this one, which is, by the way, a very good book because of the subject matter. It's nicely written too, but the subject matter is what makes it a great book. And there's a story in there about a man who, at his first meeting with Swami Kriyananda. So the backstory that is included in there is he described an experience he'd had a couple of years prior to the time that he met Swami Kriyananda in Houston, Texas, sometime in the early 80s or the late 70s. And this man had sustained an injury. Somehow he'd been hit on the head with sufficient force that he fell unconscious and actually began to exit his body. And he started up the tunnel of light, and he reached a point in that exit. Isn't this interesting? I can just say he started up the tunnel of light, and I don't really have to spend a long time explaining that. I mean, 30 or 40 years ago, you couldn't just say he started up the tunnel of light and have people know what you were talking about. I mean, it's still very early Dwapara, but it is early Dwapara. I mean, a lot of things which were not known have now become common parlance because of the near-death experiences that people talk about. So this man was having one of those experiences, and he started up the tunnel of light, and he reached the point where he was in the presence of a being of light. And he described vividly to me, and I tried my best to put it into words, into written words. He described vividly that in the presence of that light being, separated as he was from his ordinary ego consciousness, he said it wasn't that he had no desires, because he was an ordinary young man. I mean, he has very good spiritual karma, so, and has demonstrated that in the decades since. A level of dedication to the path means that he wasn't an ordinary young man, but he was living a life that looked like anyone else's, and he had lots of interests and things he wanted. So it wasn't that, as he said, it wasn't that he didn't have those desires. It was in the presence of that light being. He said any desire, all desires were vaporized. It was even said they couldn't, even before they started, they were dissolved in that light because there was nothing to want. When you were in that light, all need to move outside of that presence was dissolved by that presence. So that's what I thought of when I'm reading, rest contentedly in the self. You know, contentment is the opposite of desire. And desires don't have to be lavish and enormous. It can be just the desire to shift my foot because it feels a little uncomfortable. Or it can be the desire to take a drink of water because my mouth feels dry. Or it can be the deep longing to have a child so that I'll have something to give my love to. Or the longing to be recognized by my peers. Or the desire to have power over other people. I mean, it can range a huge gamut. But what it is that there's an impelling force that makes it necessary for us. We're not content. Now, bear in mind, much of that compelling force is God sent and is essential, because if we weren't compelled like that, we would never face and overcome. We would never be compelled to generate the energy to have the experiences to learn the lessons. So it's the compulsion that's really the issue. It's not the actions. Because if we're just moving contentedly in the self may still require of us many actions. Our karma may require of us many actions. But if everything we do while still remaining, resting contentedly in the self, you see how different that reality is. It's very subtle, and this is what we're talking about here. So to go on with the story of my friend, he talked about the spontaneous dissolution of all desires and the feeling of absolute contentment, which he'd never, I mean, he knew about it theoretically, but he'd never experienced it till then. And then the next time he experienced it, as he described it, is when he asked Swamiji, he met Swami Kriyananda, and he asked permission to kneel and touch his feet. And so he describes how Swami at that time, well, let me say it this way, Swami never, we were in America, and he never encouraged the Indian custom of touching his feet, although some spiritual teachers at the time, mostly those who were from India, it's just the way it's done. In India, if you try to get people to stop touching the feet of a spiritual teacher, it feels so inexpressibly rude to them not to do it, that it has to be allowed. It's the way they express respect. But in America, it's not common culture, so Swamiji discouraged it. He more than didn't encourage it, he discouraged it because he felt it was not natural to our culture and would not further the work that he was sent by Master to do. In later years, because he spent a lot of time in India and a lot of us spent a lot of time with him in India, it became more common. But this young man got permission because he wanted to, and he knelt in front of Swami and he touched his feet. And then he talks about how as he was coming up, Swami leaned over and he looked into Swami's eyes. And as he described it, looking into Swami's eyes, he immediately went back to that same moment when he was in the presence of that light being. I don't think that my friend tried to explain it completely, but what he was really tuning into was Swami's consciousness, because that's what happens when you look into someone's eyes, is you look into their soul. And Swamiji was exceedingly active in the world, but he rested contentedly in the self. I have asserted that he was Jivan Mukta, which means there was karma running, but there was no ego to which that karma was attached. It's a subtle point, which is explained in this book later. But he was contented in the self. Swamiji often commented that just nothing was worth it to him for him to lose his inner peace. Nothing was so important that he would lose his inner peace over it. And it, for times, there were hard times when he had to generate more willpower than not to remain in that state. But nonetheless, and I think what happened was Swami transferred that to my friend. And so for a moment he stood in Swamiji's consciousness and felt what that was like. There's another story in here actually of another, from another woman, from a different person, from a woman who talked about being just being at a satsang with Swamiji, sitting right next to him, right on the floor. And she said at a certain point, she somehow felt that she transferred inside Swami's body. I mean, these are subjective experiences, but she's a very sane person who told me the story. And she felt suddenly she was seeing the room as Swami saw it. And she realized that everyone was just light. There's just every person who had a physical form was actually just emanating divine light, because that's what we really are. The physical body is the gross expression of the active presence of divine consciousness, the self within. And she said for just a moment, you know, how long in time it was, she can't say. But she actually saw the room as if she were sitting inside Swami's body or standing behind him. And instead of seeing all the faces and all the egoic karma that's associated with everyone, she could just see them pulsing in different ways as light. That's what Master said once to a group of his disciples. Oh, he said, if you could see yourselves as I see you, you will realize that you are nothing but light, nothing but beautiful light. These are really marvelous realities to meditate on. Just in the depth of a meditation, just imagine oneself, imagine everyone you know, imagine the people that you love, imagine the people that you don't love, imagine the ones that you actively don't love, and just really feel this thread of divine consciousness, that the body is just the merest facade over this pulsing divine light. And there's just no difference among any of us. I was thinking about a person that I know recently who's been faced with a very difficult challenge. And there's lots of things I could say about, you know, what lessons there might be to be learned or could be learned or still to be learned and so on. But I had to feel deep within myself that the person, well, I'll back up just a little bit. There was someone at Ananda Village who was not the most highly competent person, who had a lot of conflicting karma. And Swami commented that so-and-so, this man, was doing very well, considering who he is how Swami put it, which we all were sort of amused by that. You know, considering who he is, he's doing very well, which is to say, he can only be measured against himself. We can't change the past. And who, I'll use myself, who I am right now is the result of all the incarnations I've had before, all the decisions I've made before, and many of them, in retrospect, were not the wisest, but to use my own favorite phrase, it seemed like a good idea at the time. And it set in motion certain karmic patterns, which I carry in my chakras, and certain karmic compulsions, and certain karmic debts, and, you know, this specific personality, this specific body. I mean, all of this, none of this is random. And here I am at, you know, my point of spiritual dedication, and all I have to work with is what I am. Merely because I've become dedicated to the spiritual path, it doesn't allow me instantaneously to just become someone else. I remain in this body. This body continues to age. Its gender remains the same. Its essential characteristics and all of the personality behind it, the parents I came from, everything. I can't just reverse that. It took a long time to get here, and this is who I am. So it's not worth lamenting sort of the raw material that we have to work with, because that's what we have to work with. The only thing that matters is what we're doing going forward, you know, what direction we're facing, and how avidly and energetically, we're moving forward toward our goal. Directional development is what I was saying before. And so success is not an objective reality. It's not how many hours you can meditate, how selfless you are with your money, how, I don't know, whether you get angry or not. I mean, all of those things are nice, but the real sign of progress is compared to who you used to be, who you are now. And someone who appears to be very good and very pious may actually be making less progress than someone whose life is much more tumultuous. Because the tumultuous person, considering who they are, might be really moving forward rapidly, but their bottom line of chaos is just bigger than this person over here. Swami used the phrase once, this is not entirely apt, but related. He said, some people appear pious, but they're not really pious. They just don't have the energy to sin. And so some people who seem to be sinning more may nonetheless have more energy going towards self-transformation. So let me just find where I was going with that. Give me a moment. Oh, yes, considering who we are. So saying about that person that, you know, he's doing very well considering who he is. And I just had a very strong revelation considering an acquaintance of mine and whose life I peripherally know. Because on one level, there's a lot of delusion still present in that person's life. But at the same time, they've been through a very hard time and they've come through it very well. So considering who they are, they're doing really, really well. The amount of delusion left, so to speak, if you could quantify such a thing, is less important than the energy being applied to overcome delusion. You see what I mean? How very complicated it gets? So that's, you know, anyway, that's very fun. These are very useful things. I'm doing very well considering who I am. Sometimes victory is not, cannot be objectively measured. It can only be measured against oneself. Swami Kriyananda was very pleased once with one of the children in our school. We'd organized, that was at Ananda Village, they'd organized a little track meet among the local neighborhood children and at some other schools. And when he asked one of the children, did you win? And he said, no, he said, but I won against myself, meaning I did my best performance. And if it wasn't the best performance in the meet, that doesn't matter. Compared to myself, I put out my best energy and I had a very good day. I mean, isn't that what we, how we really want to be? What does it matter if we're better or worse than someone else? What really matters is the degree to which we're putting ourselves forward and doing the best that we can do. Resting contentedly in the self is part of that. And again, it's not in action. It's not in action. It's inaction. It's not being still and not acting. That's what I'm trying to say. It's recognizing that the only thing that matters is my consciousness. And as long as my consciousness is right, everything else will follow. That's where there is Dharma, there is victory. So, then moving along, the number, that was all in 317 and 318, and I'll repeat it again, such a person who rests contentedly in the self has nothing to gain by performing action in the world, nor anything to lose by not performing it. He is dependent on no one and nothing outside of the self. This is the first sentence, the second sentence of this commentary is also very interesting. First of all, first sentence. Ego was defined by Paramahansa Yogananda, by Master, as the soul identified with the body. I mean, that is just a brilliant definition. Also because it's neutral. People use the word ego. Oh, they say, oh, it's just my ego. It's just his ego. I find that reference too imprecise to be helpful. Of course, it's his ego. Everything is his ego. What isn't? Until we're freed from ego, it's all ego. But identified with the body, the soul, which is the jiva is the right word for it, the spark of individuality, which makes us forever ourselves, which is infinite in its nature, has become identified with this limited expression of infinity. And this can be the physical body, and it can also be the astral body, which is the energy body which manifests the physical body, but we're identified with it. The reason I have karma, the difference between a jiva and mukta, and one who isn't, Jivan Mukta means freed while living, is that I identify with this separate individuality. And therefore, the things that this individuality is compelled to do, the experiences this individuality has, the memories of those experiences, all of that, I'm identified with it. I think it's me. I feel like it's me. I think of myself as female. I think of myself as a small female. I think of myself as of Jewish origin, of being born in Texas, of being facile with words, of being a mediocre singer. You know, just like all of these different things. If I were going to say, who am I move through the world with those identities swirling around me. That's my ego, this infinite self. And I also identify with the infinite, but not to the extent that I don't identify also with this finite egoic self. I'm not committed to it. I mean, meaning that in theory, I know that's not who I am. But because I identify with it, my subconscious overrules my intellect. I was in the car the other day. There's one of those moments, you know, where you think you might be hit just for a second. I'm always impressed by the fact that I tense at such a moment. I contrast to that with the story and autobiography of a yogi, of the sadhu walking down the road that the police mistook for a murderer who they were trying to capture. And because the sadhu did not respond to their calls to stop, one of the policemen, and I think you would have to call it an overzealous action, picked up an axe or a sword, and he actually severed the arm of the sadhu in order to get his attention, I guess. But the sadhu just didn't even flinch. He just picked up the severed arm, reattached it, and by his miraculous power just stuck it back on and healed it, and calmly said to the policeman, I'm not the murderer you seek. I mean, it hadn't even been articulated. He just knew. You know, even such a brutal assault on the physical body did not cause the sadhu to react because he wasn't identified with the body. It would just, something happened to a body in the proximity of him, but it wasn't him. So Swami says, the ego, the soul identified with the body, that identification drives one to action in the false belief that this world is real. Here we go again with something that we have to just really think about for a long time. Identifying with this physical body compels one to action because of the false belief that this world is real, that I have to eat in order to be sustained, that I have to respond when people around me talk, that I need relationships in order to have comfort in my heart, that I have to have something to do or else I'll die of boredom. I mean, just all these, just start from the top, and it just, the list goes on and on, because we perceive this world as real. We identify with the ego instead of resting contentedly in the self, and so we react to this world in a very different way. Now, if we rest contentedly in the self, that doesn't mean we don't participate in the drama. But Swami Kriyananda asked, when Master was talking about being William the Conqueror, who was a great warrior, who helped establish the country, who did establish the country of England in the, you know, 1100. Swami asked, and Master took that role in a subsequent role as a king in Spain, long after his spiritual liberation. So Master's resting contentedly in the self, yet he's having an incarnation of war and kingship and conquest. And Swami asked him, what is it? How can you participate in a life like that if your consciousness is infinite? Master's answer was slightly enigmatic, but very interesting still. He said, inwardly, you never forget that you are free. Because, you know, William just participated in life as if it were real. He gave his full willpower and energy to it. But inwardly, he always knew he was acting on behalf of God. He was never, it was happening through him. It was never he that was doing it. Very subtle to contemplate. I mean, that one of the reasons that creativity creative self-expression can be such an aid on the spiritual path, even to the point where when you read Swami Kriyananda's book, Art is a Hidden Message, it's almost said that you have to become a creative artist before you can become a saint. But when we are acting creatively in tune with the higher flow of energy, not, well, to a certain extent, but the more elevated the level we're tuning into, the more this experience happens, one enters a state of total self-forgetfulness, in which the only thing that exists is the energy that's passing through, and there is no thought of the self through which it is passing. And anyone who has lost themselves in service, really, in service, whether it's creative artistic self-expression or just complete dedication to that which is flowing through rather than the self through which it is flowing, then we begin to get an experience of acting in this world, but realizing that the only reality is not what we're doing, but the energy that's flowing through us as we do it. And that the joy of that experience, just the joy of total loss of self-awareness and absorption in the other. And it gives us a taste. It gives us a taste of what it feels like to be free, which is why artists become quite attached to that experience. And that experience can then lead you to higher dimensions of that experience. But sometimes it gets very difficult for artistically creative people because they become outwardly attached to that experience rather than resting contentedly in the self. It gets a little complicated. But nonetheless, it's a positive direction. It's a way of gradually spiritualizing and overcoming and ultimately transcending sort of all the things that tie us. So Swami goes on to say, these stanzas are not meant to imply that enlightened souls cease from acting. God himself is the divine playwright after all. So then Swami just goes through this whole thing, which is a helpful image, that this is all just a drama put on by God, and that it's a plot with a happy ending. And there's an absolute inevitable goal to it, which is, in the end, we understand that it was always God acting through us, and that we then rest contentedly in the self. And it says in stanzas coming up that the sages have to be active in this world, otherwise they set the example. And if they don't serve this world, then we will never know how to behave. Because the man of enlightened consciousness is the one who sets the standard for everyone else. Whether or not the whole world recognizes that or not, it is the fact of it. Let me just, I was giving a class the other day, Saturday morning, which was, the end of February 2020, a few days ago. And the subject was grief and death and dying and so on. It's posted probably on the YouTube somewhere, my channel. And this one woman told a story, a very heartrending story, about a friend whose daughter at the age of 19 had been in a horrible car accident and went into a coma and has been unable from that point forward to take care of herself, to function in any normal manner. The daughter's now 45. And her friend, she and her husband, who were the parents of the daughter, so vehemently disagreed about whether or not, basically to remove the life support and let the daughter die, that they ended up divorcing. And the mother has devoted herself all these, 25 years, just kind of maintaining a relationship with a child who is an adult woman now, who is completely non-functional. And without whatever it is that supports her, she wouldn't even be alive. So the woman in the class was just, I don't know, she was asking me to comment. I'm not really quite sure what I was supposed to say. I don't know what she was asking exactly, so I answered as best I could. You know, there's many levels of this. I'll start with something that Danyon Brinkley said, who was well known for a time because he talked a lot about near-death experiences and so on. And he described a quality that has come into our culture because we're so atheistic, because we are so materialistic, because we think matter is the only reality, because the ego compels us to act because we think this world is real and we think this world is the only reality. So this is who I am, and if I lose this, I lose everything. This meaning the physical body. If I lose this, I lose everything, so therefore I have to hold on to this body as much as I can. There's no thought of karma or destiny, of being part of a greater reality, of Divine Mother, Heavenly Father, taking care of us, of reincarnation, of the consciousness continuing, of the physical body being an expression of the consciousness, but consciousness operating completely independently of the physical body. So when the physical body is threatened, we do everything we can to keep it. He called that life greed. Just as people are greedy for money or greedy for food, they're greedy for life itself. So when life begins to slip away, they will try to hold on to it at any cost. So that's a tricky one, because I've never given birth to a child. I've never been pregnant. I can't speak from experience of what that feels like. But of course, I've done it many lifetimes. So I can imagine. I can easily imagine the compelling desire to protect and nurture, and therefore the extraordinary reluctance to allow that life to terminate, that life being the relationship being defined by the presence of the physical body, if you're going to call yourself mother and daughter. So I sympathize. And if there is no context that says the soul has a destiny it's trying to escape, then who's to say? And she might have believed, I'm sure she believed, her daughter would come out of it. So that's one side of it. And I can't criticize. The other side of it is, who knows what incredible karma may be being paid off. You know, one can, I find it useful to make up apocryphal stories. A story doesn't have to be factually true to be true. This came to me, a friend of mine has a severely mentally incapacitated adult child who, you know, it was one of those situations where it would have been easy to just let the child's incarnation end almost as soon as it started. But there was a compelling desire to keep that soul in that body, even if that body was not going to function. So again, 40 years later, this man is still having to be a full-time caregiver for this child with no end in sight. And he sort of took me to a very private place where his wife and no one else could hear and asked me, you know, why would this happen to me? And maybe it was intuition, maybe it wasn't, but I thought for a moment, I said, well, let's just imagine. Let's imagine that you get married young and you're 30 years old and you have four young children and you realize that the woman you've married is of no interest to you and somebody far more interesting comes along and it would just looks better and looks nicer to just go away and leave that woman with those four children to raise. I mean, that's a scenario that is not hard to imagine. What would be the karma of that? I mean, one kind of karma would be having shirked the responsibilities of parenthood in one lifetime. You have a debt to pay, you see. You've taken a certain freedom, but you took it at the expense of a responsibility you have, so the karmic scale is imbalanced. You owe parental duties to the universe to bring it back to zero. So you have a child that remains a child and you have to be the father of an infant effectively in terms of the compelling duties that you have for your entire life. You can see how it can come back to zero after that. Then the debt is paid, and you can go forward in a more balanced way, and there'll be some karmic memory that I can't just walk away from responsibilities. I won't get away with it. Even if we don't actually consciously remember what we did, we have a sense that this is not going to work out. We just know somehow that this is not going to work out. And even if the temptation is there, we find another way to solve it. I'm not speaking that there's never cause for a family to break up or anything like that. I'm not being dogmatic. I'm talking about energies, and I'm talking about how one thing relates to another. So also going back to this woman who, the mother, the daughter, you know, again, maybe the mother had been terribly irresponsible and the karmic debt. She had to act out motherhood on a scale that seems so far beyond the ordinary because perhaps she had not carried it out appropriately in the past. That's an apocryphal story. Maybe the daughter herself perhaps had misused freedom in other incarnations and needed to be confined, just had the karmic balance was the necessity to be confined, perhaps having been terribly irresponsible, or maybe she had caused the confinement of someone else, or been terribly uncompassionate, unhelpful, even cruel to someone else. Perhaps it wasn't even negative like that, but just the necessity to not be in control, to have to surrender all control to someone else, and just be content letting others completely take care of you. Maybe there'd been a desire, like a suicide desire or a drug addiction desire, to just be blank. So the brain is just damaged and nothing can be expressed. No responsibilities. I have no responsibilities. An exaggerated desire to have no responsibilities. Now, all of these are just ways of thinking, because what I had to finally say in the end is an incarnation seems extremely long while you're living it. It just does. It's just, there's a lot of days. Parents often say when they have new infants and new children, the days and nights are long, but the years are short, is how they describe it. Because you think it'll never end when you're taking care of an infant, but then all of a sudden your infant is a teenager and you don't know where the time went, and you miss the little baby. But an incarnation seems very long when it's happening, but we've had countless incarnations, almost literally beyond count. And each one was just a chapter, just rolls over like that. I've shared before, and I'll say it again, a woman friend who was in the last week of her life, and she was dying very consciously. She knew that her case was terminal, and she'd had a conversation with her doctors, and basically said, you know, I'm not going to survive, so how shall I die? You know, what kind of medicine, what kind of hydration, what kind of nutrition? And she was just very consciously just letting her body go because there was no possibility of it surviving. And she talked about, she said to a friend, she said, I'm lying here. And she said, I'm watching thousands of faces. She said, thousands. Thousands of faces that I recognize. I mean, not just a crowd. She wasn't saying I'm seeing crowds of people. She's saying I'm seeing thousands of faces. And I recognize that each one was me. Each one was as much her as the one she was sitting in right at that moment. Now imagine, I mean, this is why in normal life we don't remember these things. Because, heavens, we can barely deal with the story that started at the start of this one. Imagine if we had all those stories running in our minds. But she was dying. And she was a very advanced soul, and so she was resolving a lot of karma in her conscious release of her body. But she was seeing all those faces, and she just said, how can I cling to this one? She said, all those faces have come and gone. It seemed foolish is not the word. It seemed preposterous ludicrous. It was a ludicrous idea that she would cling to this face when there had been so many other faces before it. You know, that's quite the opposite of, this is my body, I must keep it at all costs. It's like, bodies come, bodies go. So there we have what can only be what most people would call, and I would too, certainly painful, conceivably even tragic circumstances between that mother and the utterly debilitated child whose you know, youthful promise had just been smashed in an instant like that. But who's to say whether it was good or bad in the end? And who's to say what the right decision really is? It has to be determined by intuition, because this is a divine drama, and God is the playwright. He's the one who's writing the script. And what happens when we begin to rest contentedly in the self is that we see and feel the whole experience as leading somewhere. You see, what makes life so difficult for so many people, and even for dedicated devotees, is to just keep that awareness ever foremost, that everything is purposeful. And more than that, everything is essential for the ultimate realization of bliss. Everything happens exactly as it must happen. I'm not going to get in the question of free will. That's not what I'm talking about. But there's a divine drama here. And we just have to do the best we can, considering who we are. And that's all that God asks of us. I was contemplating that the other day in a particularly difficult situation, personal relationship that I've been sorting through for some time. And I think I've done fairly well with it. But I've also been angry and impatient, and I've said things I shouldn't have said, and I've had feelings I wished I hadn't had. I wonder, when is it good enough? I mean, when does God say you've succeeded? What does success really look like? Because I know we can be so close to it that we can't really tell. And is that even a useful question? I think the only question is to just persevere. Persevere with the best attitude we can have and leave it in God's hands. There's no way to tell. As Master said, karma is like a nail that's put into the wall, and you're trying to pull it out, but you don't know how long the nail is. So you don't know if you're pulling on a half-inch nail that's just going to pop out, or if you're pulling on a 6-inch nail that you're going to have to pull on for all of this lifetime and all lifetimes, you know, 6 or 7 more before you get it out. You just don't know. So the only thing one can do is just persevere with the best we have, resting contentedly in the self, and realize that everything leads to bliss. This is what the presence of the saints does for us. They just have this magnetism of faith in God that gives one more faith, that's all. I've commented on it, but this rest contentedly in the self reminds me of it. I had the opportunity to be in the company of Swami Kriyananda quite a bit over the course of his lifetime. He died in his mid-80s, and I met him when he was 44, so I knew him through all that time. Because whenever I was with him, I never wanted to be anywhere else. That was enough. I mean, I could rest contentedly in the self when I was next to him, near to him. Not that that would be inaccurate. But I understood more clearly what it meant to just not want to be somewhere else, just to be where you are, because that was his consciousness. It was the same as I was saying to my friends, about my friends, that they transferred into his. So it was, and I would often think about, and of course my sadhana, even though I was often with him for the second half of my life, or more than that, I didn't live where he lived. I didn't live in the same community. I didn't even live in the same country for years at a time. So it wasn't like it was every day. But I realized that it was an example. Being with him, yes, it had a profound effect on my consciousness, But it was meant to show me what was possible in myself, because it was myself I was experiencing. And if I was capable of it anywhere, why not everywhere? I had that lesson really early when I was running the kitchen at our meditation retreat. And Swami Kriyananda would give Sunday service. First he gave it every Sunday, and then he started giving it every other Sunday. And in between, one of the other ministers would. And it was the habit for everyone who came to Sunday service, which was most of the community, that they would always stay afterwards and we'd all have lunch together, and I would cook lunch. When Swami Kriyananda was there, I would devote myself to making the best possible lunch that I could. When he wasn't coming, I would just, you know, serve whatever I happened to have on hand, really casually. Carelessly is almost the word. And then one day I realized how much I enjoyed being very conscientious and making a really beautiful lunch compared to just putting any old thing on the table. And I also realized that Swami would not be pleased if I only took care of him and considered everyone else unimportant, because that's not how he felt. So I began, it was the beginning of my understanding, that it's what flows through you that gives you joy. And if one allows the best that one can possibly generate to flow through one as much of the time as possible, then all the benefit goes to oneself, because that high energy flow, that positive, God is everywhere and I serve God in everyone, spirit is the joy that we're seeking. So all of these things are worth remembering. Well, let's go to number 319. Therefore, Krishna says, strive conscientiously during the performance of all actions, whether physical or spiritual, to act without attachment. By activity without self-interest, one attains the supreme. He says, physical actions are performed by engaging the life force on a material level of reality. Spiritual actions are performed by withdrawing the life force from the physical body. To act spiritually in this world means to be conscious of the indwelling self and to radiate that inner consciousness outward to others and to the world. He said, attachment is the rope that binds. Okay, here's the word simply, which is self-interest, and that's the small s, self-interest. It's the lack of self-interest that is the meaning of non-attachment. People think non-attachment means a lack of concern or a lack of commitment. That's a great mistake. Swami Kriyananda once remarked, contrasting his own nature with that of someone else, he said, so-and-so appears to be more non-attached than I, Swami Kriyananda, are, because that man was a bit aloof. And Swami said, but he's not. He said, I'm more non-attached than he. But Swami was more committed to everything he did. And this man thought he was maintaining non-attachment, but he was actually just aloof. And that aloofness was a protection against pain, against failure, against embarrassment, against being thought unspiritual because being too much involved in the world. In other words, self-interest. What about me? What do I appear to be like? What if I make a mistake? What if I get bound? A lot of times, people's lack of commitment is not really a lack of involvement or desire, but it's an expression of their fear of making a mistake. So the spiritual path gets really subtle, which is why souls like Swami Kriyananda and Paramhansa Yogananda, it's why they incarnate, because they're showing us what this high consciousness really looks like. You know, it's not, the word actually is fear. It's just, sometimes we hold back from the world because the world frightens us. We're afraid it's going to hurt us. We're afraid it's going to, we're afraid of getting karma. This is another section of the Gita. You can't get out of action by inaction. You can only get out of action by acting without consciousness of self. And so Swami Kriyananda was
far more committed and far more active and far more dedicated and far more engaged in this world, basically, than almost anyone I've ever known, or in the sense of putting energy out in this world. But his entire motivation, his only motivation, was to serve God. At the end of his life, and actually I tell the story in this book too, which is also, by the way, a very good book, Light Bearer, which is a book I published just last year. It's a wonderful book, if I do say so myself, because of the subject matter. But I tell the story at the end of there, toward the end of his life, in the last years of his life, Swami took a pilgrimage to Medjugorje. Medjugorje is this place in Yugoslavia, where for the last, or what used to be Yugoslavia, I don't know what they call it now, where the Virgin Mary has been appearing to six visionaries for some 30 years. And most of them still see her. Some of them still see her daily, and others see her once a month or even less. But the whole of that small area has now become a massive pilgrimage scene where literally millions of people go and experience the power of the visionaries and the power of the visions that people have had. And Swamiji had the opportunity to meet a couple of the visionaries, one of whom he felt particularly close to, Vishka. It looks like Vicky in English, but I think it's Vishka is how it's pronounced. And he was there when she was having a vision of Mother Mary, the mother of Jesus. And afterwards, Swami, who felt very close to her, said, "Ask Divine Mother," which is how he felt Mother Mary was an expression of Divine Mother, "ask Divine Mother if there's anything more I could do for her." He said, "I've done everything I could think of to do to serve her, but please ask her if there's more that I could do." I was, when I heard that, I wasn't present, but it was offered to us in a letter from one of his companions. I just thought, my, what a consciousness. By that point, Swami had been a disciple of Master for more than 60 years, and pretty much every single day of his life, Swami had done as much as he could do to help bring into manifestation Master's vision for his work, and to bring into manifestation through Swami's consciousness his attunement with the Guru. And yet so humbly, he says to this woman, "Would you please ask Divine Mother if there's more that I could do?" Oh, to be only, you know, to be able to ask a question like that, you know, be in the presence of a visionary where you could ask anything you want. And that's what Swami asked. Later, of course, someone said, "Did you ever get a message from her?" Swami said, not outwardly, but inwardly I have felt her response. But he didn't say more. Oh my, you know, when the final moment of our life comes, Swamiji himself says in another place, which is also I put in that book, he said, "When I die and I meet Master again," he said, the only question Master will ask is, "Do you love me?" And Swamiji said, "My reply will be, you are all I have ever loved." God bless you.